until you break.
Good morning, Kingston, and welcome to the superhero themed pro bono radio show on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Dun dun dun!
Please feel free to check out the station's website at www.cfrc.ca, where you can find past shows or listen live. Before we get started today, I would like to remind you that we are students at Queen's University in the Faculty of Law, and as such, we are simply giving our opinions. We are not lawyers and are not dispensing legal advice. With those formalities in mind, let's begin our show. My name is Heather, and my two co-hosts today are Joy.
Hey.
And Colin.
How are you doing?
Today we will be taking our inspiration from a blog that was created by two American lawyers, James Daly and Ryan Davidson. James is an attorney licensed in Missouri and a graduate of the Washington University in St. Louis School of Law, class of 2008, and currently works for the Stanford University Hoover Institution. Ryan, on the other hand, is an attorney licensed in Indiana and a graduate of Notre Dame's Law School, class of 2009, and is currently primarily working in the area of insurance law. Both of these men were brought together by their love of comic books and the law, and the intertwining of the two. This passion led to the creation of a blog called Law and the Multiverse, and it can be found online at lawandthemultiverse.com. In this blog, the two analyze common scenarios that occur in the comic book worlds created by DC and Marvel and apply American law to them. Today, we will be presenting to you the issue of vigilantism and two topics taken from the Law and the Multiverse blog, along with their application in Canadian law. I would like to remind you that none of this would be possible without the generous consent of James Daly and Ryan Davidson for the use of their materials. Now, just so that we can see how these topics are relevant to the real world, Joy has an interesting story on how some people in the United States are taking the law into their own hands.
Yeah, so apparently there are some people in Seattle who have formed a group of superheroes called the Rain City Superheroes, which apparently is part of a wider real-life superhero movement that I had no idea existed until a couple weeks ago. But there was an article written about this guy, Phoenix Jones, and his colleagues include Thorn, Buster Doe, Green Reaper, Gemini, No Name, Catastrophe, Thunder 88, and Penelope. And maybe Red Dragon. We're not sure about that.
Very creative names in there, eh?
Yeah. So apparently these guys go around Seattle and attempt to fight crime in tights and capes and bulletproof vests, which is a good upgrade, I suppose, if you're not actually a superhero. According to him, he's actually been stabbed and shot at various times, so I don't know what to say other than that, really. But let's move on to Colin's discussion, and we're going to come back to the idea of vigilantism at the end.
Okay, so given my general attitude towards criminal law, I generally avoid this subject as it can be rather depressing and a daunting area of the law. However, throw supervillains into the mix, and I will make an exception. As I was skimming through the blogs on lawandthemultiverse.com, I came across a very interesting piece of work. The article discussed supervillains and the defense of insanity. Over the next few minutes, I will be discussing whether the defense of insanity is available to supervillains within the Canadian legal system. As I passed this idea by a few of my friends not in law school, many of them rather quickly concluded that the defense of insanity would be available to a great many of these obviously loony villains. Well, although I would agree that most famous comic book villains generally have a troubled past, and may have a few screws loose, it's not that simple. Before we begin to discuss the fun stuff, I feel obligated to discuss briefly the defense of insanity in general. First off, just because you successfully argue the defense of insanity does not mean all is forgotten and you're back on the streets. If you are legally insane, then you have what we call a disease of the mind. And like any disease, it can be treated, or so the theory goes. So, If a supervillain successfully argued the defense of insanity, he or she would then be submitted to a mental health facility to be treated and released once they are no longer a threat to society. Therefore, in theory, you could potentially spend more time confined to a mental health facility than in jail. Should an accused have a particularly difficult disease of the mind to treat, as a supervillain likely would. As a result, you generally only see this defense used in cases where the defendant faces the option of lengthy prison sentences. Okay, but a fundamental question still remains. What qualifies as insane within the Canadian legal system? Cooper and R. provide some guidance. This case reveals, in order to support a defense of insanity, the disease must be of such intensity as to render the accused incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the act or of knowing that it is wrong. The key word in this definition is appreciate. Basically, the criminal law system has decided that if one cannot appreciate the act one is committing, then there should be no guilty conviction. This seems inherently tied to the concept of foreseeability. In this case, the defendant's judgment would be clouded by a disease of the mind, possibly by a hallucination or some other mental fiction. Just another note that Cooper and R. demonstrates. The legally relevant time is the time when the act is committed. So, even if the insanity was temporary, it can be used as a defense if it prevented the accused from understanding the consequences of his or her acts. But where does that leave us with our supervillains and their ability to plead the defense of insanity? Well, it seems the Canadian system will come to much of the same conclusions as the blog at lawinthemultiverse.com. The Joker, for example, despite his obvious abnormalities, would not be able to establish the defense of insanity. He may very well be insane in layman's terms, but he simply is not the right kind of insane within the legal system. The Joker knows full well what he is doing, and he certainly has the capacity to appreciate the disastrous effects of his acts. Otherwise, I doubt he would do them, being a supervillain and all. Further, Kelsden and R. is a case which holds that there is no requirement that the wrongful act be accompanied by appropriate feeling about the effect of the act on other people. So, essentially, despite the fact that many supervillains have complete disregard of their wrongful doings, this doesn't help them establish the defense of insanity. So, let's say Venom, one of Spider-Man's greatest enemies, kills a number of innocent bystanders without remorse. That simply does little for him to establish insanity. A good example of a supervillain who could use the defense of insanity, as discussed by the Law in the Multiverse blog, is the Hulk. When the Hulk goes berserk and is smashing through downtown Kingston, he is unable to appreciate the qualities of his acts. The fact that the Hulk talks in third person and only has a two-word vocabulary comprising of Hulk smash, I think any trier of fact would agree. The Hulk lacks the mental capacity to pass as a sane individual. To conclude, I really can only think of the Hulk and possibly the Lizard, a Spider-Man villain, as being able to use insanity as a criminal defense. Most other supervillains are particularly resourceful individuals, capable of appreciating their acts. In fact, most supervillains only commit their crimes they do because they know of the ill effects their actions will have on society. For example, Dr. Octopus, Lex Luthor, and Dr. Doom are all high-functioning individuals. Who knows, if they weren't bent on ruling the world, they may very well be contributing members to society.
Regardless, maybe they'll be lawyers.
Or they could be lawyers. Regardless, the defense of insanity is actually not as commonly used or as simple to argue as it would intuitively appear. For that reason, let's leave the supervillains to the superheroes to handle, instead of the Canadian legal system. Okay, enough about the bad guys. Heather is now going to discuss some issues superheroes face in the legal system.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. My one issue with that is that, to me, Hulk was not a supervillain. He was actually a superhero, so the plea of insanity is not there.
That is debatable.
He was a good guy.
Well, I mean, you never know.
Yeah, he can be a bit of a troublemaker sometimes, so that's arguable.
All right. So my questions are regarding superheroes. What are their rights? What are their responsibilities? Does Superman have to rescue Metropolis whenever it is in danger? Does Batman have to protect the innocent from harm? What if instead Batman chose to go for a coffee instead of helping the man being mugged? Most comic book strips operate under the assumption that superheroes have a duty to protect civilians from evil. As pointed out by the Law in the Multiverse blog, from a moral standpoint, this is probably true. Any passerby would think negatively of a superhero who did not react to a robbery or did not try to stop evil from occurring. But legally speaking, in both Canada and the United States, there is no duty to rescue. Since there is no duty, there cannot be a case for negligence. We must assume that this will hold not only for the average Clark Kent or Bruce Wayne, but also for Superman and Batman. In Canada, and in the United States, there are exceptions to this negligent rule. The first of which is that if a person has created a dangerous situation themselves, then they have a duty of care to rescue those who are endangered by it. This can be found in the case, in Canada, of Sprat and Edmonton City. In the Law in the Multiverse blog, they give the example of Spider-Man and his web. If Spider-Man sets a web trap for Green Goblin, it says, he has a duty to rescue any people who are caught in it. This can also be expanded to cases of stopping fast-moving vehicles very quickly, thus endangering people inside. In Canada, for dangerous actions to be excused, there must be evidence of the existence of an emergency. Therefore, if Superman stops a speeding train because it is about to go off the edge of a cliff, he does not have to do it slowly, but he can do it as quickly as possible to save as many lives as possible, even if it could cause some bodily injuries to those inside the train. The second exception that could make a superhero negligently responsible comes from the creation of a special relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant. Now, the special relationship can sometimes be seen as that between parents and their children, between spouses, or between property owners and invitees. Here we're going to look at the special relationship between emergency response personnel and the general public. Under the common law, police officers have a responsibility for the general protection of life and property, and other emergency responders also have a similar obligation. Could superheroes be considered emergency responders by the law? According to the blog, no, they couldn't. Since the emergency responders only have to provide assistance within the scope of their employment and have no legal duty when they are not on duty, superheroes would have to be state actors to be found to have legal duties to respond to emergencies. The interesting possibility of them having to save everyone and to be legally responsible to save everyone would mean that anyone that they did not save could technically bring them to court, which would mean that they would probably spend more time in court than they would actually on the street helping people. Uh-huh. This would not make for a very good legal system.
Or a comic book.
Therefore, superheroes do not have the responsibility to save people. They have the right to days off like the rest of us. It is only by their inherent good nature that they choose to, as was put by Batman, silently watch over the city as its proud inhabitants sleep soundly at night until the silence is broken by any renegade with the will to break it and the means to do so. And that's when they spring into action. If a superhero does decide to act, they must act in a reasonable manner to avoid harm to others. Once a person steps into rescue, they voluntarily assume that duty. But where a person is dealing with a serious or sudden emergency, he or she will be held to the standard of conduct which would be applied if it were voluntary negligence. Their actions will be judged in relation to the danger and its suddenness. In a situation of emergency, a person is not expected to act as he or she would in a cool and deliberate frame of mind, nor are they expected to act superhumanly as was noted in French Encantos. This is, of course, a small problem for our superheroes who naturally act superhumanly.
So, just an interesting scenario is what happens when a superhero fails. It rarely happens, but as is the case in the death of Gwen Stacy in Spider-Man, what if it did? The story behind her death is described on Wikipedia as follows. The Green Goblin abducts Parker's girlfriend, Gwen Stacy, and lures Spider-Man to a tower of either the Brooklyn Bridge or George Washington Bridge, I'm not really sure. The Goblin and Spider-Man clash, and the Goblin hurls Stacy off the bridge. Spider-Man shoots a web strand at her legs and catches her. As he pulls her up, he thinks he has saved her. However, he quickly realizes she is dead. Unsure whether the whiplash from her sudden stop broke her neck, or if the Goblin had broken it previously, he blames himself for her death. A note on the letters, the Amazing Spider-Man 125 states, it saddens us to say that the whiplash effect she underwent when Spider-Man's webbing stopped her so suddenly was in fact what killed her.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Because Spider-Man didn't actually throw her off the bridge, and therefore is not responsible for her being in danger in the first place, and there's really no other way for him to save her, the fact that his rescue attempt is the cause of her death will most likely not make him liable. In Ontario, the Good Samaritan Act actually says that a person who voluntarily and without reasonable expectation of compensation or reward provides a service as described in a previous section, which would just be basically rescuing people, is not liable for damages that result from the person's negligence in acting or failing to act while providing the services, unless it's established that the damages were caused by the gross negligence of that person. So Spider-Man would probably not be legally responsible, even if in his mind he continues to be tormented.
In Ontario. Not sure the law in the States is the same, though. I think it's a little bit more stringent.
Actually, in the States, they have the same one, interestingly
enough. Oh, really?
In Canada, we actually have Quebec, that they are legally obligated to actually help people. But
yeah,
they are still limited to
that.
Yeah, they are still limited to the reasonable standard.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah, that'll be decided by the court later on. Yeah, as I was saying about Quebec, the Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms enacted in 1975 in the Civil Code actually contains a provision that imposes an obligation to render aid if it can be accomplished without serious risk to the Good Samaritan or a third person. Every person is obligated to act as they say in French, bon père de famille, which is a good family father, basically, broadly defined as a reasonably prudent person. Failure to do so would amount to fault and lead to legal wrong. So make sure when you are in Quebec, act like a superhero up to a certain limit. We can all be Phoenix Jones.
Or at least a good father. I wonder if that's a different standard than the good mother standard.
That's a good question. Another good superhero.
Another show.
So a superhero in Quebec may be held liable and could be expected to help all those they can. There are, of course, going to be limitations, for instance. There can be negligence where a superhero's actions are extraordinarily risky and the damage they seek to prevent is relatively trivial. The examples given by the multiverse are, for example, using legal force is not reasonable if it's to stop the Joker from vandalizing a museum, because it would then be a tort and a crime. But if we look at the case of Gwen Stacy, it would be reasonable to kill the Green Goblin in order to save her life, but it is not reasonable to take the whole bridge down with all the other people on it, which, you know, maybe the Hulk would do that. We don't know. If he was a supervillain, he might.
That's right.
The last example is that of Darkseid, who threatens to destroy all reality. It would be difficult for any prosecutor to argue that anything that is done in an attempt to prevent that from happening would be unreasonable. It was also advanced by one commenter on the Law in the Multiverse blog that there is such a thing as the Godzilla threshold. This is described on another blog known as the TV Tropes and is as follows. Things are at a point where even summoning Godzilla, king of monsters, and patron saint of collateral damage could not possibly make the crisis any worse. The situation has crossed the Godzilla threshold. Once the threshold is crossed, any plan with the possibility of success, no matter how ludicrous, impossible, or dangerous, suddenly becomes a valid option. This is, of course, not a legal doctrine. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that superheroes do not have to spring into action unless they are in Quebec and then the law can decide what to do with them. Furthermore, they are responsible if they act in a way that is inconsistent with what a reasonable person would do if a reasonable person had the superpowers, let's say. Now, I think Joy is going to start talking to us a tiny bit more about her vigilantism in the real life crime fighters that we have in the United States right now.
Yeah, I just, before we do that, I just wanted to comment on that. It's an interesting question, too, because then there's a weight, like a hierarchy that gets placed on stuff, right? So it's like, well, simultaneously, there were these two horrible things going on, so I have to pick which one is the more horrible one that I have to, you know, deal with. So that's a pretty dangerous road to go down. Also, I was going to ask Colin, I don't know if you looked this up, but in the case of temporary insanity, what happens in sentencing if you're no longer a threat? Does that mean you just go free?
Yeah, so if so that actually happens, and I've actually read a few cases where there's temporary insanity. So they're maybe only insane during the short period where they commit a crime. Well, if they're once they go to sentencing and they're no longer seen as a threat to society, then basically it's up to the health board to determine if they're, I guess you could say, cured of the disease of the mind. And as long as there's a very improbable chance that there'll be a recurrence, then yeah, they can have a full acquittal.
It's an ideal defense, I guess, then.
It is, yeah. Difficult to prove, though.
Yeah, hopefully. All right, so questions. Vigilantism. So in case that's a little bit of a confusing term, I guess what we mean is vigilante being a person who goes off to seek their own justice, Robin Hood style, rob from the rich, give to the poor kind of a thing. So what are some problems with, because we were looking at this article on real-life superheroes who want to go out and be the justice in the world. What are some problems with this? I was brainstorming a few things. I think, number one, it encourages people solving their problems on their own.
which we don't want.
Which discourages, like, conversely, reliance on law enforcement. And we don't want people spending their resources on private forces instead of on the justice system. And we don't want justice to go to the strongest and most wealthy, basically. back to trial by combat, as I said in my notes here. It also encourages violence and the ends justify the means thinking. So, you know, well, as long as he got what he deserved, then it's okay that I, you know, took unlawful means to do it.
Who would decide who is right and who is wrong?
That's my next point. Make citizens the judge and the jury. They get to punish how they see fit.
And executioner.
Yeah. and also, one big problem is that there are no protections in place. So, in other words, if I decide to execute my own superhero justice, what stops me and what redress can people seek? And the answer is probably none. but that's the main problem, right? So how far does the scope of this problem reach? And I mean, it could basically go into a lot of areas. I saw this one Law and Order Special Victims Unit recently where this little kid decided to pretend to be a police officer, and he actually hunted down and caught this rapist guy in the park. But then there was a huge kerfuffle about what kind of evidence they were allowed to bring in and whether it was unlawful search and seizure and this, that, and the other thing. So, it was a huge mess when all that needed to happen was for the police officer to arrest him in the first place. There are issues in terms of, like, bounty hunting, private security offers, and, dueling. People might just go out there and do it old school.
When it comes down to the evidence thing, I know that the Law and the Multiverse actually wrote an article on whether the evidence brought in by Batman to Gordon, whether that would be held in court or if that was seized without a warrant.
Yeah, it's a big issue. And then, you know, constitutional, if someone's acting as a state actor with or without state permission, does that mean there are rules in place there? So just before I ask you guys what you think, I just wanted to sum up what protections are in place for citizens going off and doing their own thing and against it. In the criminal law, there is actually a provision that you can do a citizen's arrest, but there are some limitations on that. There's, as we referred to before, the Good Samaritan Act, which allows you to give first aid to someone and hopefully not do it negligently, but if you do, you're okay. There's defense of self-defense, defense of third parties or property. However, usually in these kinds of defenses, there's a bit of a proportionality issue. against vigilanteism, there are laws against sedition, which is basically promoting anarchy or mutiny against law enforcement, and also against riots or any kind of mob behavior. And then if you look in the civil law, I mean, it's basically the same kind of a thing. But I would further note that if you try and booby trap your property to prevent crime, you could end up facing charges if you seriously hurt someone. So that's been interesting. But what do you guys think?
Well, I just think we've invested all this money and time and resources into this incredible infrastructure known as the criminal legal system in Canada. And to have, you know, vigilantes running around, I don't know, it kind of is counterintuitive to me. It goes against the Canadian system stands for, and I'm sure what the American system equally stands for.
Mm-hmm.
So I just say people leave it up to the legal system and just call 911. It's
yeah.
safer, it's easier, and it's what it's there for.
Don't tackle people running
yeah.
from your store with candy.
Yeah, so...
with candy.
It happens.
I'm sure it does.
Do you have anything to add?
No, I think we covered a lot of the points that superheroes could encounter in their day-to-day lives.
So basically, don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless you do have superpowers. And then, by all means, please try.
Well, then maybe you need to see a shrink. Well, that's another issue. So I'd just like to thank you all for listening to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM. Again, I'd like to remind you that we have a website, cfrc.ca, where you can find past shows or listen live. Also, CFRC is starting its fundraising drive tomorrow.
Capital F-U-N.
So everyone here at Pro Bono Radio would love if you could be a superhero and donate. Also, listen next week for a special episode on Pro Bono Radio. Thanks again for listening. Good morning.
I'm thinking why, yeah, Superman's dead.
CFRC presents Tom Boyfriend, Thursday, February 10th at the Mansion, 506 Princess Street. Based in Toronto, Blox Recording Club artists Tom Boyfriend make a rare journey to Kingston in support of their new album, Don't Go to School. Their performances are a whirlwind of politically charged glam rock presented with costumes, fake blood, bird masks, and participatory dance moves. Joining them on the bill are Kingston's own Sleuth Bears. Don't miss the show. Thursday, February 10th at the Mansion. Admission is $5 to $10 sliding scale at the door with proceeds to support CFRC's funding drive. For more information, visit cfrc.ca.
Hold your head up. Hold your head up, I'm tired of.
On February 9th, at the Mansion, come see some garage rock with The Lost Cause and Kingston's own Aiden Campbell. DJ LK will also be spinning some tunes, playing some records. This show is part of CFRC's annual fundraiser. Come to the Mansion on February 9th to support Campus Community Radio and Garage Rock.
Garage Rock.